For those of you who were curious, yesterday I was trying it off on the table. It wasn't picking up much at all. But have it in the pocket. Someone suggested a headband that would let it dangle right here in front of my face. That would be good. Okay, for those of you listening on the web, this is the review session for HDFS 60 on 3 March 2006. All right. What would you like me to go over? What kinds of questions have you?
I was wondering what you were looking for the question about how these things change over time. How these things change over time, a person's activities, relationships.
Oh, yeah. How does everything change over time? Huh. They do. Thank you for that question. And that's from the expectations for the eco exam page in the syllabus. And it's one of those questions that you throw in to something without actually thinking about it very much. And in all of the years that I've used that sheet and given the eco exam, no one has ever asked. So I'm confronted with, what the heck does that mean? And we can probably construct something that will fit with that. Okay, so what goes before that is what? What are the few items that that's attached to? Yeah, I'd probably better look at it. Okay. Okay, so that really, the question, how do these change over time, refers to the ones under it. Now I remember writing that. How do these things change over time? A person, activities, relations, roles, settings, microsystems, the mesosystem, the exosystem. You might as well throw the macrosystem in there too. Okay, how do these change over time? Without going into a whole bunch of detail, very interesting challenge. You sure you don't want to withdraw the question? Okay. It really is one of those, oh, well, this is a course in development, therefore we ought to throw in how things change over time to make you think about it. And so what questions, what answers have you come up for that with, for that so far? How does a person change over time? Okay, and so that's a biologically driven, they become more mature was the answer. So people change over time because we have genes that change across time and change the expression, and that makes our bodies change. So we develop more stature, we develop changes in metabolic rate, we go through puberty, we age. So people change over time in part because we're biological organisms that have a lifespan and a set of changes built in. We're also experiencing, and as time passes and we have different experiences, we are affected by those experiences. We wear down our teeth, for example, through the process of eating. We have accidents that cause injury. We abuse our livers by drinking and our lungs by living in polluted air and those sorts of things. So those are all biological processes that are the result of just living and transacting with the world. And then we also make sense out of experience. So from a constructivist point of view, and this is sort of the heart of development, of human development, from a constructivist point of view, we're making sense constantly and changing the way we understand the world, changing the things we can do, gaining a better understanding of the world that we live in, a more valid view, having experiences that expand our understanding and our skills. So for Bronfenbrenner, the definition of human development has change built into it, implied by the word development. And in his view, if you look at the person, you're looking at a person who is acquiring gradually through experience a more differentiated and valid view of the world that we're experiencing, and skills, because we're constantly adapting to the challenges that are provided in that environment. So we're constantly changing the skills that we have to allow us to use the understanding that we have to adapt to the world and to make sense out of it and to change it. And we're also, he says, developing gradually the motivation to maintain our world or to change it to make it more fitted for the things that we want it to do. Okay? So the person changes over time for several reasons, and that's the process of development. So Bronfenbrenner is assuming that. And what's important for him are the two things of the understanding of the world based on your experience and the skills to adapt to the world and to change the world and the motivation to maintain yourself and the world. And then what he puts together in the definition of the ecology of human development is that it's the study of that developing person, that person going through life, in the context of an ecosystem which is also changing. Okay. There's a mutual accommodation between the changing person, person changing for all of those reasons, and the environment, which is constantly changing. The aspects of the environment we're in change constantly for other reasons, partly because it's full of other people who are also developing. So the people that we're involved with are also changing. So if you think about being in a social world where everybody is going through development, everybody is constructing understanding, you would expect that any relationship would change. So any dyad, any relation is subject to change because both people in it are changing and they're having experience which they're making sense out of, including the experience of the relationship, the experience of each other. So that relation that's formed by that dyad of two people who are constantly changing the relationship is going to change to reflect that. You can then add the same thing for every aspect of the ecosystem. We're constantly changing. Time passes, events happen, the world changes, our settings change, partly because the world changes and partly because the people in it change, and those are transactions. The people and the world keep changing. So in a sense, what underlies that question is the assumption that nothing really stands still for very long, especially if human beings are involved. But then within his framework, does that make sense? You know, that the study of human ecology, the field of human ecology, is the study of the relationship between the changing person and the changing environment that we're in. We put kids in different settings. We move them around. We change the settings. And so we're constantly encouraging people to make sense out of new things because we move them around. We give them new experiences. We make them take new courses. We end the semester. We give them spring break and force them to move out of the residence hall so they've got to adapt to that. It's just constant. Your environment is constantly changing and making different demands on you, giving you different opportunities, giving you different risks. Okay? So that piece makes sense, I hope. Then within that, within his framework, there are particular aspects of relations, for example, that are important to look at. So if you're going to think about changes in a relation, a particular relation may change, it will change because the people in it are doing different things. And one of the typical ways a relation changes is to change its type. So the relation goes from being an observational dyad to being joint activity to being primary and potentially to being a developmental dyad. So a dyad can change by changing what's happening in it and the way the two people in it regard each other. So if they start thinking about each other over time when they're not together, it's become a primary dyad. Okay. This is an interesting way to look at all of the features of the ecosystem as he defines them, by looking at how each of the characteristics in each element can change over time. That's the intent of that particular question. I had just never tried to answer it out loud. The relation can change. It's going to change because people in it do things differently. And if you're thinking about a relation, what do you always think about? Okay, it's happening in a dyad, but what are its characteristics? Affect, reciprocity, and power. So what can happen over time to the affect? It can get more positive or more negative. So people feel differently about it. The reciprocity can increase or decrease. Yeah. So there can become more reciprocity over time. People are engaged, taking initiative more equally over time. Yeah.
I still get confused, but I guess the affect, but the sense of power and reciprocity, like,
dance
together.
Reciprocity and power are, they're sometimes related to each other, and sorting them out is sometimes difficult. But the short and easy way to do it, let me finish the first thought that's in my head so I can dump that and move on to the next one. Power can change so that it becomes more equal or less equal. Okay, so the power in a relation can become more equally distributed or less equally distributed. And those things are all important changes in Bronfenbrenner's sense, in his framework, because as a relationship changes so that the dyad is engaging in more positive affect, they're happier with it, it has more developmental potential. As the reciprocity increases, it has more developmental potential. As the power becomes more equally distributed, or as the less developed person acquires more power or is granted more power in the relationship, then the relation has more developmental potential for that person. If you are losing power in a dyad, particularly if you're the less powerful person, if you're the less developed person, if you're losing power, then probably the relationship is becoming less positive, less facilitating for your development, because you're losing the ability to initiate activities, to direct what goes on, to choose the things that are going to happen in it, and you're going to have less, be taking less initiative in deciding what you're going to learn from, or in influencing what you're going to learn from the activities that the relationship is engaged in. Okay, now back to the question of the difference between reciprocity and power. Reciprocity primarily refers to taking initiative and trading, passing the roles back and forth. Deciding what you want to do. Deciding what you don't want to do. Taking turns. Influencing the other person and being influenced by the other person. Okay, so it has to do with the back and forth activities and whether or not each person is taking the initiative, whether or not people are engaged in the same kinds of activities in the relation. Independent of how much influence there is. Okay. So the reciprocity refers to the back and forth, the sharing of roles, the doing the same or different things in the relation, while power refers to how much influence you have over the other person, or how much the other person has over you. And the two are clearly related, because one of the ways that you exercise power is to not let the other person initiate anything.
Okay. So basically just like reciprocity is what it is, and then power is how much.
Right. Yeah. The comment was reciprocity is what it is, who's doing it, and the power has to do with how much, the force involved. Yes.
So would as a reciprocity of the balance of power being more equal?
It's more likely that if there's a high degree of reciprocity, the power is going to be more equally shared. So the two tend to be related in that way. And one of the challenges we had in class one day was to think about a situation where the reciprocity would be low, but the power equally balanced. Or vice versa. How can you have a high degree of reciprocity and very imbalanced power? That one's hard for me to come up with a good example for. I can come up with one where the power is equally shared and there's very little reciprocity, I think. Right. Yeah, the example of very traditional roles where they do quite different things might be an example where there's not much reciprocity, but the power might be equally shared. They've just divided it differently. Yeah. What reciprocity in what kinds of things? They may not be sharing roles, but I think the example that I made up in class was trading roles, doing pretend stuff with the child, paying a great deal of attention to the child, and being very responsive to the child, so the child is initiating games. And even in infancy, it's important that there is reciprocity, that you pay attention to the child. The child is typically going to be paying very close attention to you, and if you're not responsive when the child initiates something, then there is low reciprocity, and you want high reciprocity in it, but ultimately the power is still with the parent. But where I tend to see them as blurring is that in a situation where a parent is being very responsive and the child is able to initiate things, so there's a high degree of reciprocity, the parent is already in the position of granting the child a great deal of influence and power. So I'm not sure quite how to sort those out. What's important in the long run is not making a fine distinction between the two. It is an important question, but not so much to understand development. It might be important in looking at how a particular relation is changing and sorting out, are they increasing or decreasing the reciprocity? What's happening to the power? But that's what's really important. How is the relationship changing? Is it gradually becoming more reciprocal? If it's not, how could I make it more reciprocal? So that's a question for parent educators. If I'm working with parents and I want them to develop more reciprocity in their relation with the child, then how do I do that? How do I teach them to engage in more reciprocal activities? If I think it's important for the child gradually to be given more influence and power in the situation, how do I do that without blurring the roles, without undermining the parental authority that might be important? But it gives me a way to think about what it is I want the parents to think about and what I want them to practice. If I want to increase the positive affect, then I want to teach the skills of doing that. And there are parents who don't have any positive affect in their relationships with their children, or at least their children don't know it because they never show it. They're not affectionate, they never give praise, kid never satisfies them. So it's important for people to understand how to increase the positive affect. The same thing if I'm doing couples counseling. In a couple relationship, are there arguments about reciprocity, power, and affect? You know, if I want to put on my developmental hat, I'll say, yeah, let's look at those aspects of it. They're having a problem. Are they sharing the power? Are they both reciprocating? Do they have a high degree of reciprocity? And then how can I get specific about how to engage in more reciprocity as a couple and more affect. So I can focus my questions in ways that get me to the aspects of those three aspects of the relationship, find out if there are issues that I can interpret in that way, then I can give advice and have them practice things that will increase the reciprocity, make the power more balanced. And if you just listen or read, just all you have to do is read Dear Annie in the paper, and you get a whole, get a lifetime experience of counseling and the issues in relationships. Almost every week there'll be some complaint by somebody about their couple relationship. And by golly, they are often about affection. I think maybe yesterday or even today. Anybody read the Free Press today? Or yesterday, I'm not sure which day it was. But the problem in the relationship was that this couple has been married for 29 years or something like that. I don't know why details like that stick in my head. The husband is not affectionate with his wife, but he's very, very physically affectionate and demonstrative with his mother. This is beginning to bug the wife, because he holds hands with his mother, and he hugs his mother, and he smooches with his mother, and lots of positive affect in that relationship with his mother, but not much in their relationship. So the wife is wondering whether she ought to complain about this or worry about it. Is it sick? Or so they're asking the questions. But essentially they're saying, if it's been 29 years, you've been putting up with this, maybe it's not going to change much. You're not going to change his relationship with his mother, but maybe you could ask for more positive affect in your relationship with him. But that's a question about affect in the relationship. And what's really annoying her is that he's not doing it with her, and she sees that he's capable because he's doing it with his mother, and she's jealous, appropriately so. He's also doing it with his sisters, and they've figured out how to bug the writer. So, lots of times you get questions about power. Lots of times you get questions about reciprocity. I do all these things for my husband. How can I get him to reciprocate? And why doesn't he ever remember my birthday? He says, I love you. Isn't that enough? No. It's nice, but prove it. Demonstrate it. Engage in reciprocal thoughtfulness. Remember our anniversary and don't give me a vacuum cleaner. On it. So it's possible to use the Bronfenbrenner to kind of categorize the complaints that people have and then to focus. We'll talk about that more in the next unit. Okay. As we go on down through that list, how do settings change over time? And the purpose of that question really is to get you to think about the ways that these different components of the ecosystem might change, and as you're looking at a particular example, how are they changing? The physical characteristics of settings can change. Typically, that's a deliberate sort of thing, that we remodel, we throw out stuff, we tidy up, we create storage, we put in a bathroom, whatever it is. We add a bathroom to the tour bus. And whatever setting you're talking about, you can change it in specific ways. And Bronfenbrenner's point is that when you change those specific ways, what goes on in that setting and what can go on in that setting may change. And that moves you then to the next major element, which is the microsystem that exists in that particular setting. And the setting may change an important way that settings change is that the people in them change. You have new people or you take people out. And when you add a person or take a person out, you change the microsystem. You change the relations that can exist. And the microsystem is the pattern, remember, of microsystem is the pattern of loud roles. Good. Activities. Relations. Right. So you were saying interpersonal relations, and I was. RAR. Not to be confused with the RAP of reciprocity, affect, and power. Roles, relationships, and activities. Anytime you think about a setting, you think about the microsystem in it, which is the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities. So, roles can change, activities change, we've already talked about relations changing, the pattern of them can change. So a microsystem can change because the roles change, the relations change, and or the activities change, and or the pattern changes. And since it's a system, if you change one of them, you're likely to change the others as well. So if I change my setting, fun example. You've got an apartment with six people. You live in it. You're all students. You have one bathroom. Activities. Waiting in line for the bathroom. It shouldn't be molar, but it is. Yeah, you can imagine what the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities is if you have six women sharing one bathroom, and it's a one-holer with one small sink and one small medicine cabinet. Right. You don't want to do that. But you can anticipate that there would be conflict, there would be frustration, there would be some frantication, there would be some, you know, get the heck out of the bathroom, I need it now, I've got an exam in 20 minutes and it's going to take me 15 minutes to get there and I have to do my hair first, whatever it is you do in the bathroom before an exam. Okay. So the relationships and the affect are going to reflect the fact that you don't have enough resources, bathrooms, for the number of people in the situation. If I come into that setting as the landlord and I remodel it by adding a bath, then I've got six people and two bathrooms. Will I change the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities? Yeah. Will I change the relationships, the affect in the relationships? Yeah. I'll have a big impact on that microsystem. Which is why people remodel their houses. And especially why they add baths. Especially as their kids get older. So, going back to how can things change over time, if I change the physical setting, I'm going to change the microsystem, the pattern, and as I do that, I may change individual roles or relations or activities in them, because it's a system. They're all connected together. How do roles change over time?
Mm-hmm. undoubtedly you leading will change the role of value for siblings.
Right, because and the observation is that if you leave for college and have a younger sibling, the younger sibling's role changes, and that's because they're all connected. It may change the younger sibling's activities and the relations that everybody has in the household. It's going to change, in fact, the microsystem, because the pattern is going to change by removing a person. When you remove a person, the roles that person has been filling may become open for other people to move into. And often your role changes just because something happens. So one of the ways that roles change in relation to the people who occupy those roles is that those roles get occupied by different people, or people take on new roles or lose roles. So changes in roles come about for any number of reasons, but what it means is that sometimes you have a new person fulfilling the role, sometimes it means that you don't have anybody filling the role, sometimes it means that you're taking on a new role as a person. Those are all subtly different from each other, but anytime you change people, you change how the role is played. Roles can also have changes in their expectations. So, for example, I'll go back to the parent education example. If I'm doing parent education with a group of people who are having difficulty in parenting, one of the things that is going to happen if my education is successful, if I have influence on their parenting, they're going to see the parenting role differently. So they're going to change the role. The role is going to respond to their experience of parent education. So they're going to see that it can be, and perhaps should be, carried out differently. If a role is a set of expectations, if you change the expectations, you're changing the role. If you change a role is also a set of activities, and if you change your ability to carry out those activities, if you gain more skill in them, or less for some reasons, if you gain more skill in the activity, then you play the role differently, which is why we send people who are moving into responsible roles, we send them to training. Department chairperson is a role at the university. There's never been any training for that. You just do unto others as was done unto you. We call that the brass rule. Now, there's the golden rule, do unto others as you wish they would do to you, or you would have them do unto you. There's the brass rule, which is you do what other people did to you. You just pass it along. It's not necessarily a good way to play the role, because you may have been exposed to people who were not very good at it. The university has added training for department chairs to help them figure out what the role is, what are the expectations, and to get better at the activities. We do that in staff training all the time. Okay. So changing the expectations and or increasing the ability, changing the activities, the way people play the activities that make up that role. We take on new roles in all kinds of ways. We start dating somebody. You just became a boyfriend, girlfriend. You have a kid, you become a parent. You get divorced, you become a divorcee. Never been there, never done that before. How do you play this role? What's expected? You get married, you become a spouse. You've never been one before. How do you do that? But people are constantly doing that. You become a grandparent. You become a retiree. You become a displaced person. Hurricane Katrina blows your house away. You're a refugee. Never been in that role before. How do you do that? Somebody gives you a dog. You become a dog owner. What are the expectations in the role? Activities. I didn't realize we were going to spend the... you know, you just structured the entire review session. Helpful? It seems to me like something I should be doing in lecture. I should be answering that question in this way in lecture at some point, because I've never tried to do it before. I appreciate that. How do activities change over time? They become potentially more complex. Is it?
Yeah. They include more people or different people in different settings. They develop.
Okay. So they may become joint activities when they weren't before, or they may become non-joint activities, something you do alone. You think about learning to walk. It's a joint activity. You got your parent holding you up, but then you can do it on your own. They can move from being molar to molecular, and as you get more familiar with them and they get easier to do and get incorporated into more complex activities. So then it's a question, is the activity becoming less complex because you've mastered it, or is it becoming more complex because it becomes bigger? Both of those are happening at the same time. The individual parts are becoming simpler to you, and they're becoming a smaller part of the overall activity as the activity becomes more complex. I'm sorry. Can activities be links between settings? No. Well, some activities are links because some activities are communication. So talking on the phone or writing email is a molar activity, which creates the indirect links of communication between settings. So yes, I can. And that process can become more complex. It can become a more effective link as it becomes more complex, or as it just becomes more efficient. You engage in it more often, put different kinds of information in your communication, direct your communication to different people, and it becomes more effective. Yeah. Is that what you were thinking of?
Yeah.
Isn't it fun when we ask questions when we don't really know why we're asking them? Do you know why we do that? Do you have a theory of question asking? Just as an aside, it goes back to, if you want to explain it, if I want to explain it, I go back to a constructivist notion that I have a whole bunch of things that I understand, and part of developing knowledge is to figure out what the relationships among the different parts are. And one of the ways you connect parts is to ask questions about connections. And often what we're doing as we ask a question is we have, some people would call it intuitively, we have in our mind connected parts and recognize the potential connections, and that leads to a question. And part of what you want to do is get in the habit of asking questions and think about how parts might be related to each other and use that to generate questions, and then the answering of the questions gives you more information about how the parts are connected to each other. So that's the little aside about knowledge building from a constructivist point of view. And then there's the big picture view, which says that actually everything is related to everything else. So we just ask the questions about anything. You can randomly generate questions how is this connected to that? What's the difference between this and that? Okay, enough theory of mind. You look puzzled, okay. All right. Activities can become more complex. They can be joint activities. They can be shared across settings. You can carry them from one setting to another. You can engage people who are less developed in the activity as a joint activity, as a way of teaching and sharing it. And then you can stop doing an activity. An activity may not be supported in a setting that you go into. So it's connected to the settings that you're in, because as you move from one setting to another, the particular activity may become more or less possible. As you change relations and settings, a behavior may become more or less likely, which is why if you're recovering from an addiction, two of the things that are recommended are that you move, put yourself in a different setting, and change your friends. Okay. You want to go someplace where it's harder to engage in the activity you're trying to quit, and don't hang out with people who do it. So you make the activity less likely. And that's one of the hardest things for people. But your ecosystem supports the activities that you may be addicted to. And if you continue to hang out in the same parts of the ecosystem with the same people, it's harder to quit. That applies to gambling, drinking, drugs, delinquent behavior, sexual addictions, eating, any of the things that are a problem for you. Are supported or not, more or less supported by the settings and the relationships that you're in. I eat a lot more when I'm working if I'm in the dining room at home, which has a nice big table and lots of sun, and I really like it. It's a comfortable place. It's right next to the kitchen. And from almost any seat at the table, you can see the refrigerator. But if I go up to my study, which is on the second floor, it's a pain in the neck to go get something to eat. So you don't do it. Or you do it less. I had a college friend who studied every night sipping vodka. We were permitted to have alcohol in our rooms, and he had learned to drink his vodka neat, out of the bottle. He'd pour a large glass and he would sip. He was a Russian languages and literature major, so it made sense. You know, the vodka was going to help him learn. Bizarre.
It's kind of related, not the vodka.
Okay. Yeah, please, get us off that one. Change the subject, please.
That would include kind of like first-time experiences, lessons in something. I understand it, but I'm not familiar.
Okay. Anybody want to explain developmental trajectories? Rontgenbrenner has a specific definition, and what he's talking about is the pattern of activity and motivation. So he's saying that you have a trajectory of a particular activity that you're involved in, that you're engaged in. And it's a developmental trajectory if it is supported by a series across time, a series of settings, the microsystems in particular settings. So if you see yourself having some particular interest and motivation to do a particular thing, like oil painting or ballet dancing, and you pursue that, then what he's going to suggest is that you can trace the settings in which that behavior has been supported and encouraged. And it's supported and encouraged by the microsystem in particular settings. Because it was possible. You had lessons, for example. You got introduced to the activity. Say it's music, playing the piano. That might get started at home by listening to recordings of people playing the piano. And it might be started because there is a piano and somebody plays it, and so you get to bang on the piano. Okay, now do something that is really helpful. The comment is it the lessons or is it having the piano available to bang on? And something that you can do the rest of your life, particularly when you're dealing with something as complex as an ecosystem, is every time you ask a question with an or in it, substitute and. Is it the having the piano to bang on and the lessons and the aunt who pays you $5 when you play the piano at her house and the opportunity to play piano in fifth grade and the recitals that lead to you getting flowers and your grandparents are absolutely ecstatic because you play the piano and the opportunity to go to Juilliard and the fact that you can make a lot of money in on the concert stage playing the piano. For a systems person, it's not this or that. It's typically this and this and this and this. And that's what he's describing as a developmental trajectory. The fact that you had this opportunity and then in another setting this opportunity and then in this one and then this one, those all support the activities and interests and motives that are important in creating your life. Now the practical application of that point is to think about the things that you do and then think about the settings that encourage them and how the microsystem in each setting encouraged this connected developing interest. And what that lets you do then is to take a behavior, an activity or an interest or a motivation that somebody has that you don't like. Alcoholism. Take that example. And to assume that alcoholism doesn't appear out of thin air at some point when you're 25. What are the settings and activities that have encouraged it, that have led you to focus yourself so much on making sure that you have alcohol available all the time because you don't want to live without it? Think about drug addiction. Think about being a college professor. Think about being a wedding planner. Whatever it is that you might think of wanting to do, it has a potential developmental trajectory. And if you want to do it, for example, if you're a kid who wants to be an astronaut, then we'll start pushing you into the settings that will support the skills that you need and the interests that you need to nurture to get you there. That's called career planning. Or it's called understanding how somebody developed a problem. And what sustains that problem now so that you can bend the trajectory. It's one of my favorite concepts in Bronfenbrenner. If I have a pattern of motivation and activity that I don't like, I'm not going to stop it, most likely. I'm not going to tell somebody, stop being dyslexic. It's not going to happen. The problem has developed over a series, or has not been changed over a series of settings. If I want to bend it, if I want to change it, I have to think about new settings and new activities. That's called treatment, it's called rehabilitation, it's called support for doing it differently. So the developmental trajectory continues, but can be bent. You can move it in a different direction so the problem becomes less of a problem. If I want to think about parenting developmentologically, my responsibility as a parent is to make sure that the child has access to the settings in which the microsystems are going to encourage the things I want to develop. That means I provide the piano. It means I provide the piano lessons. It means I support going into the settings that are going to make those things happen. Again, recognizing that it's a developmental process, and I, as the parent, may not be able to teach a kid to play the piano. If you want to develop that trajectory, don't hang out with me, because I'm not going to teach you to play the piano. But I can get you into the settings where people can, and I can sit and listen to you practice, and I can applaud, and I can support you in doing that. So, developmentally, the notion of developmental trajectory is really, really important, because it combines the activities and the settings that are going to shape the long-term skills and interests that the person is going to have. And if I'm particularly interested in particular ones developing, I need to make the ecosystem support them. I have to take charge as the parent. Or if I'm a teacher or a guidance counselor, or and you think of all the other people who help kids get into settings where they're going to develop the skills that you want them to have. You get a kid in 4-H, you get a kid in church groups, you get a kid in sports, whichever ones you want. And if you don't like the development that's happening, then you do the ecological analysis of why it's not going the right way. What is supporting the behavior that you don't want? And how can you change settings? And parents do that all the time. They see a kid not developing academic skills. They take the kid out of the public schools and put them in a private school. That's an attempt to bend the trajectory on their assumption that the private school will support the academics. Kids leave high school with very good hockey skills in Vermont. Sometimes. Some kids, I'm talking specific ones. They get out of high school, but they can't get into a good college. But they can play a really good game of hockey. They do a postgraduate year in prep schools where they can go refine their hockey skills and get the academic support to get into with another year of high school, postgraduate year, to get into a college that will give them a better scholarship for their hockey skills. But they'll be able to stay there and graduate because they've had the extra year. That's bending a trajectory, making a setting available that will support both the hockey and the academic skills, and make it more likely then that the next setting that you want to get into will be open to you. Question? No, the question is, does a parent have to do it for it to be a developmental trajectory?
Okay, 'cause when I was little,
you can put yourself in it.
I wanted to play the piano, so my parents sent me piano lessons. But then I was in the other room, and I couldn't jazz band in the other room. I went in there, and I started playing trumpet. myself yeah. play piano, so I kind
right.
of put myself
yeah.
so it's still considered a developmental
yeah, still a developmental trajectory. And your parents still get credit because they put you in a setting where you could hear the jazz. They didn't know that was going to happen. And often development reflects that kind of serendipitous thing. It wasn't intended, it just happened. But when you go back and look at it, how did she become a trumpet player? Uh-huh. She was taking piano lessons and heard the jazz band and was able to get in that room. So she took the initiative, got there, somebody handed her a trumpet. Harry James has competition. He was?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I say these things out of my what? Henry James was a writer. I know that one. Yeah. Harry James. I was trying to remember the other. Tommy Dorsey. Trombone. Right. The other Dorsey. What was the other Dorsey? The trumpeter. Right. Dorsey Brothers Band. No, okay. I may have totally made that up. There we are. That's what I know about big band jazz. But I heard Stan Kenton in person in high school. High school, yeah. Yeah. You want to touch?
Yeah.
My brother took me. Transcontextual dyad, developing a more developed person. He was in college, I was in high school. He took me to my first Greek restaurant in Chicago. He took me to see Stan Kenton. I got to see the original Chicago production of West Side Story. Big brothers are good. Okay, did we cover everything? Probably. Close enough. Different parts of the... Well, those are all different parts of the ecosystem. We didn't talk about how mesosystems change. This is an important question. How mesosystems change. And I said it Wednesday in class, I think, maybe Monday. The two important ways that mesosystems can change. One is that settings are added or dropped. If you stop going into a setting, it's no longer in your current mesosystem. Or if you start going into a new setting, it becomes part of your mesosystem. So that's one of the ways. And then the other way is that the relationships between the settings can change. You lose your transcontextual dyad, for example. Your roommate doesn't go to class with you anymore. Somebody in a setting can decide that they don't like you anymore and don't want to support your trumpet playing or whatever it is. So that changes the consensus about goals between the settings. Somebody learns something in one of your settings about another setting. That changes the inter-setting knowledge. So any way that settings are related can be changed. And the important thing is to be able to recognize when a particular event happens, how it might have changed the relationship between the settings. Okay, so mesosystems change over time because the settings change, the relationships between them change. And in an infinite number of ways. Okay, so that's the answer to the first question in the review session. But because it's a system, everything is related to everything else. And I hope the last hour has kind of given you some sense of how you work with that. So you think about each of the components and how they might be changed, and how change in one might affect another. Okay. You're not quite there yet, right? But you're getting there. You're getting close. Do we have time for another question? Feel free to leave anytime you want. I know some of you are hopeful that something exciting will happen. Okay. Yeah, there are four or five different formats in the eco exam. We try to keep them short and entertaining. So one is just simply gives you the definitions and asks you to match the concepts to the definitions. So you've got both. You've got a list of the concepts. You've got the definitions. All you have to do is match them. So just you've got to be able to recognize. That's the kind of puzzle we do, you know, for fun on weekends. Another section gives you a list of possible things that you might do to a setting and asks you which of the things in the list are going to make that setting more, potentially more developmentally facilitating. Similar item for relationships, similar item for microsystem. And what that's doing is taking the hypotheses and the various ways things can change and making them relatively concrete. So for all of it, the key to getting through the eco exam successfully is to A, know the material, and B, read very carefully and think very deliberately about each item. Because often when people look back at the eco exam and look at their mistakes, they go, oh my, oh, dumb, oh, duh. No, the question said microsystem and I was thinking mesosystem. Well, if the question says microsystem, think microsystem. And be very careful to think about what the question is really asking. I just emphasize that. Another section gives you some sentences, basic statements that use the terms from Bronfenbrenner, but some of the sentences use them incorrectly and some of them use them correctly. And you get to pick which ones are wrong and which ones are right. And again, the sentences are often very similar, so it's a matter of reading carefully and thinking clearly about what a mesosystem is or what an exosystem setting is in the context of the sentence. And then the one that's short answer is the we'll give you a story, a vignette, as we did in class on Wednesday. The two that I did in class on Wednesday are on the website, and the one I did in the review session yesterday is on the website. It's about Jenny and Ralph. And what we do then is just ask you to read that and then name the people in three dyads, or what kind of dyad did Jenny and Ralph have at the beginning of the story. What happened to their microsystem? They're specific questions, and you just answer them from the vignette. And I've got a file folder full of vignettes, and sometimes I make them up. The first time runs pretty much dead on 50% every year. About 50% pass it the first time. And about 5% miss it by a point or two and kick themselves. And then probably the second time around an additional 30% or so. And when we get down to the 10 or 15% who haven't passed it after the second time, some of them discover that maybe they really need to study this stuff and learn it, and that would help. And sometimes I do spot interviews of people who haven't done well, And it turns out they've never read the Developcology and they've only been to 6 classes. And I don't say anything because their evidence is right there in front of them. Sometimes, occasionally, a very small percentage of people have difficulty with the format. And so if they haven't been able to deal with the format after 3 or 4 times, then we'll do a different format. Because some people insist that they know it, but they can't deal with it in the format, but that's pretty rare, especially since there are several different types of questions. But sometimes you get somebody who does really well on 3 or 4 types of questions, and one type just constantly throws them, so all their mistakes will be in a particular section. And then we look at, oh, maybe there's something going on in the processing here. Maybe this is really a performance disability or a learning problem. The person really does know the stuff, but is having difficulty with a particular format. So then we accommodate for that. And the other advice I have is get a good night's sleep Sunday night. And if you think of other questions, email Julie or me. We're both around, I think, all weekend. I am, anyway. Because I have to make up the exams.